Well, thank you, Ed, for your kind introduction. You did it so gracefully that for the first time while listening to the introduction, I didn't feel as if I was listening to my obituary. Ladies and gentlemen, the subject of my talk is the role of ideas in the fight for liberty. It's a broad subject, and I shall try to limit myself, following a principle I've always believed in, that a talk like a miniskirt should be short enough to attract attention, yet long enough to cover the argument. I am convinced that the case for liberty is today better understood than, let us say, the last 50 years. To show this, all that's needed is to look at the prevailing intellectual climate in the 1940s. In 1947, at the first meeting of the Montparnasse Society, Hayek remarked that his goal was that of putting together a group of people who are in agreement on fundamentals, and among whom certain basic conceptions are not questioned at every step. His evaluation of the number of such people, however, was pessimistic. The number of those who in any one country agree on what seems to me the basic liberal principles is small. One could also quote a remark made by Schumpeter in 1949 on the effectiveness of the society in its infancy. After having listed a series of socialist principles, which as a result of the disintegration of capitalist society were being taken for granted by the business class and by the large number of economists who feel themselves to be opposed to 100% socialism, he added, "I believe that there is a mountain in Switzerland on which congresses of economists have been held which express disapproval of all or most of these things, e.g. socialist policies, but these anathemata have not even provoked attack." Now, we believers in freedom have come down from that mountain, but have we made any progress since then? On the question of freedom's future, opinions have always differed widely. Schumpeter himself was, as we all know, very pessimistic. At the time of the foundation of the Montparnasse Society, he wrote, "Can capitalism survive? No, I do not think it can. The actual and prospective performance of the capitalist system is such that its very success undermines the social institutions which protect it, and inevitably creates conditions in which it will not be able to live and which strongly point to socialism as the heir apparent." The pessimism has continued to flourish until recently. For example, I remember that at the first MPS meeting I attended in Hillsdale in 1975, a prominent member of the Montparnasse Society was convinced that England would become a dictatorship in 5 years. Though many on the British left would probably say that his prediction was confirmed by Mrs. Thatcher's rule, most of us would conclude that this kind of pessimism proved to be excessive. And today, while socialism seems to be fading away, capitalism is alive, and there seems to be a widespread revival of faith in the free enterprise system. Indeed, in political rhetoric, we have many reasons for being at least moderately optimistic in our evaluation of current trends. Political rhetoric has been changing fast in many countries, including, for example, my own, the People's Republic of Italy. 32 years ago, at the time of the 1963 general political elections, statism was the consensus of the overwhelming majority of politicians of almost all political parties. Those of us who dared to challenge the prevailing wisdom based on deficit spending, national economic planning, nationalization, and direct government intervention were labeled reactionaries and simply ignored by the new mandarins. Today, things have changed drastically. Let me say a few things about my country. In 1993, confronted with a collapsing political system, frightening financial disarray, confiscatory taxation, and the real danger of recession, Italians thought that all of the country's problems could be cured by a change in the electoral system. In a referendum held in April 1993, some 83% of voters indicated that they wanted to move from proportional representation to a majoritarian system. In haste, a new electoral law was approved, which replaced PR with a mixed system. 75% of senators and deputies would be elected on a first-past-the-post basis, the remaining 25% on a bizarre version of proportional representation. Elections were held on March 27, 28, 1994, with two contestants. On the one hand, there was the left, led by PDS, the Democratic Party of the Left, heir of the old Communist Party, and a large and mixed assortment of groups which included parties as diverse as the unreconstructed Communists, the Greens, what was left of the Italian Socialist Party, left-leaning Catholics, and so forth. On the other, an alliance led by Silvio Berlusconi, a successful entrepreneur and TV tycoon. He had convinced a few academics, including myself, that a new political movement had to be formed with the aim of creating an alternative to the left. A spontaneous movement began to form, and in a matter of weeks, the movement Forza Italia, come on, Italy, started to gather momentum. Forza Italia succeeded in assembling a coalition with the Conservative National Alliance in the south and the Northern League in the north, so that together they could provide an alternative to the left. That alliance won the elections on what was probably the most radical free market program ever presented in Europe. The program of Forza Italia included, among other things, a ceiling on taxation and the enforcement of a balanced budget amendment, the reform of the income tax with the adoption of a single rate system, fiscal federalism on the lines of reverse revenue sharing. This is a proposal by Dwight Lee, an American economist, whereby all taxing authority would reside in local governments, which would be required to give the central government some proportion of the tax revenue they raise, privatization, school vouchers, the dismantling of the national health system and its replacement with a private insurance system with means-tested health vouchers for the needy, and so forth. I think all this sounds familiar to you. I have elsewhere dealt with the fate of the Berlusconi government in a National Review article which John O'Sullivan very aptly titled Anti-Disestablishmentarianism, Italian style, and I shall not repeat that sad story now. The point I wish to stress is that the political debate preceding the elections of March 27-28 was entirely centered on our proposals. Liberal ideas were carrying the day, and today some of those very ideas, in a somewhat diluted form, are being imitated even by the leader of the PDS, the Party of the Left. Plagiarism is the highest form of flattery. But let me go back to the more general theme. Statements in support of economic freedom are being made by political leaders of different parties almost everywhere. And a comparable change can be observed both in the academic world and in public opinion. Isn't it tempting to conclude that we are winning? In answering this question, we must first of all be aware of the danger of historicism and be skeptical of what Sir Karl Popper sarcastically called the belief in the inexorable laws of historical destiny. Our question, however, does not necessarily entail a fatalistic attitude towards history. It's a very important question, and if we can specify its meaning exactly, it deserves to be asked. The first problem is that of specifying the time interval under observation. Over which time span are we making a comparison? Now, this is a universal problem. In the words of Fred Singer, when people ask me whether the climate is getting warmer or colder, I generally answer yes. It all depends on over what time scale we average. If the time scale is a few months, then the answer in the spring would be warmer, and in the fall, colder. The intellectual climate is now more favorable to the cause of freedom than it was 25 years ago. Does this mean that it is more favorable than it was, let us say, 10 or 100 years ago? What I mean is that there is the danger of mistaking a temporary lapse in the historical process for a radical change of direction. Schumpeter was very well aware of this when he warned, "The transformation of social orders into one another is an incessant process, but in itself a very slow one. To an observer who studies a moderate span of quiet time, it may well seem as if the social framework he beholds did not change at all. Moreover, the process often suffers setbacks, which considered by themselves may suggest to him the presence of an opposite tendency." Let me stress that at this point, I am concerned with the intellectual climate, not with actual policy. We are all painfully aware that drastic changes in rhetoric do not necessarily translate themselves into changes in policy. It is important, therefore, to separate the two and maybe ask ourselves under what conditions a change in the intellectual climate results in a change in policy. From the perspective of the ideological confrontation, I am convinced that we live in one of the happiest times in the contemporary history of mankind. It seems to me that never before has the case for freedom been more thoroughly analyzed and better understood. Now, I realize this is a strong statement. There is an inevitable distortion on our perspectives produced by chronological selection. Few people who are great thinkers in the eyes of their contemporaries stand the test of time and are still considered great by future generations. As a result, we are often led to believe that there are more great scholars among our contemporaries than there were in the past. However, even if we allow for this distortion, it seems to me still true that a very large number of the great liberal thinkers of all times belong to this century. Furthermore, even though ideas always have parents, in the sense that their origin can be traced back to past achievements, the case for freedom as presented by today's thinkers is more consistently argued and better supported than ever before. Finally, more people are aware of the importance of freedom on a theoretical level today than at any other time in the past 50 or 100 years. Let me illustrate. I think we all agree that the gravest threat to freedom comes from government. Private threats are easier to deal with. The growth of government and the resulting danger to freedom have two major sources. The first is the pressure coming from interest groups trying to secure political rents or to be sheltered from competition. This threat is more formidable because, as Adam Smith pointed out, the collusion of private and political interest is favored by the structure of political incentives. The second source of government growth has been socialism and its faith in the benevolence of government, what Frank Knight called the essential content of socialism, which he thus defined. It is imagined that the state, i.e. the government, conceived in the abstract as a benevolent and all-powerful agency, essentially as God rather than realistically as a group of politicians, could order economic affairs rightly without generating new evils or incurring serious social costs. That humanity would with approximate unanimity approve and like the result. That no other serious problems would remain. And finally, that everybody, or nearly everybody, apart perhaps from a few criminally recalcitrants, would live happily ever after. Now, at the intellectual level, both these sources of government growth have been subject to extensive critical scrutiny, and the underlying interplay of interest has been exposed. As a result, it's much more difficult today to enlarge the scope of government in the name of the public good. We now have extensive empirical evidence that regulation often ends up serving the interest of the regulated producers, thus providing a good illustration of Adam Smith's view on the mean rapacity and monopolizing spirit of merchants and manufacturers. Even more important, we have seen a dramatic shift of opinion away from the myth of the benevolent government in the past decades. That shift has largely resulted from viewing government as a group of politicians rather than as a mythical abstract reality. the sobering effect of the economics of politics on the intellectual climate has somewhat tempered the mystique of government as the problem solver, leading Jim Buchanan to conclude, "I can be very pessimistic when I look at many aspects of our current economic policy and as I contemplate post-Reagan political economy. But I am optimistic when I compare the discussion and dialogue in our time with that which might have taken place in the 60s or even the late 70s. Indeed, ideas do have consequences. The fatal conceit has been exposed, and the romantic notion will not return." The economics of politics and the economics of regulation are only two examples of our intellectual victories. Liberalism has faced the challenge of Marxism, fascism, welfareism, and Keynesianism, and it has won. Except for a few desperate, hopeless fanatics, no one believes in central planning, nationalization, wage and price controls, deficit spending, inflationary growth, protectionism, the superiority of public health care, and all the assorted paraphernalia of excuses for bigger government that were so overwhelmingly popular only a generation ago. An interesting question arises at this point. Must intellectual change be credited to the work of prominent liberal thinkers in general and economists in particular, or has it been the product of circumstances? Now, I've had the chance, as Ed was saying, the great fortune of being a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the second half of the 1960s, and I tend to attribute great importance to the work of liberal scholars in general and economists in particular. However, in Chicago, George Stigler, as far as economists are concerned, was always convinced that as a profession, economists are not relevant. In a 1959 paper, he asserted that economists are subject to the coercion of the ruling ideologies of their times, which would suggest that their output has little, if any, impact in shaping those ideologies. And he added, "I believe that the economics profession has been basically more conservative than the educated classes generally. However," he's repeated time and again, "economists exert a minor and scarcely detectable influence on the societies in which they live. And the main lesson I draw from our experience as preachers is that we are well received in the measure that we preach what the society wishes to hear." Now, on this point, I disagree with Stigler, and I tend to agree with Keynes. The views of economists are probably less important than Keynes thought, but as his own influence confirms, they are far from having a minor impact on society. Probably a compromise between the two positions can be found in the view that economists influence society only when circumstances are right, when their theories are not in sharp contrast with the organized interests of powerful pressure groups. As far as our question is concerned, there is no doubt that the popularity of liberal ideas has been reinforced by the failure of statism and the desire to find an alternative. But it's equally true that without the revolutionary contribution of liberal thinkers, both the analysis of government failure and the alternative to its problems would not have existed. That, however, is the intellectual part of the story. In terms of actual policy, things are totally different. While the rhetoric has changed dramatically, policies have not always changed much. No one advocates a socialist system, but when it comes to policy, the organized action of pressure groups inevitably leads to more government intervention. Each one of us nowadays seems to favor market discipline and competition in general, that is, for everybody else. But when it comes to his own interest, he does not refrain from trying to use the democratic political process to extract political or monopolistic rents. We demand economy and efficiency from the suppliers of goods and services we buy, but we like to have as high a pay as possible, and we don't mind being sheltered from competition in what we produce. To some extent, we are all guilty of this kind of schizophrenic behavior. I'm normally very vocal in my opposition to the growth of government spending, but don't count on me to oppose increased spending on university professors' salaries. The same is true, for example, in the field of trade restrictions. People who support free international trade in principle, that is for the others, often argue that their industry is a special case deserving some kind of protection. It may very well be that we devote more energy to promote our interests as beneficiaries of political favors than we do to promote increased reliance on market processes for society in general. This is simply a variation on an old theme. We like high prices for the product we sell and low prices for the products we buy. But our interest as producers of some good or service is greater than our interest as consumers of goods and services produced by others. And as a result, we spend more efforts to keep the price of a product high than we do to keep other prices low. Or we devote more resources to increase government intervention on our own behalf than we do to reduce government intervention in favor of others. This can explain why, if we compare the size of government's interference in our lives today, in our times of great liberal rhetoric, with what it was 25 or even 15 years ago, we must conclude that in most countries, we are much worse off now than we were then. Regardless of what measure one chooses, government has grown very rapidly in the past quarter century, and this is true, although to a different extent, of almost all Western countries. It may very well be that what we are witnessing is an illustration of the Friedman cycle, the view that a major change in social and economic policy is preceded by a shift in intellectual opinion. At first, it will have little effect on social and economic policy. After a lag, sometimes of decades, an intellectual tide, taken at its flood, will spread at first gradually, then more rapidly, to the public at large, and through the public's pressures on government, will affect the course of economic, social, and political policy. As the tide in events reaches its flood, the intellectual tide starts to ebb. On another occasion, Milton Friedman has explained that it takes a long time, and I emphasize that the reversal in the climate of opinion is one thing, the reversal of policy is a very different matter. The real change in intellectual climate didn't start until the late 40s or early 50s, so you really don't expect it to be fully implemented until something like the year 2000. Maybe so. I agree with Milton Friedman almost all the time, and I certainly hope that he's right on this issue. But how do we know that this is the case? Couldn't the present intellectual climate, as Schumpeter would say, be one of those setbacks which, considered by themselves, may suggest the presence of an opposite tendency? Couldn't the present climate, favorable to freedom, be a temporary exception in history's course? The obvious answer to these questions, of course, is that we do not know. There are no inexorable laws of historical destiny, no deterministic trends in either intellectual climate or policy. There is no such a thing as victory, or defeat for that matter. A state of affairs which once attained will forever be maintained. The struggle for freedom is a natural, inescapable component of life. We can successfully meet the challenges of our time and score a temporary victory. But new problems will soon come up as new ways of hindering our personal liberties are discovered or old ones are resurrected. The disappointing change in policy, furthermore, is to a large extent due to the limitations of our intellectual successes. For example, we haven't produced a workable, realistic plan or blueprint for dismantling the existing stated structure. The few instances in which there has been success in demolishing the socialist framework are remarkable in that there was no previous generally accepted formula for neutralizing the entrenched interests which resist any change in the status quo. It seems to me especially appropriate that the Philadelphia Society meets in the city in which the U.S. Constitution was written. That is because our present successes are especially vulnerable in that they have generally consisted in a change of policy within a given unchanged set of rules rather than in a constitutional change of rules. Constitutional arrangements are not eternal, but if correctly devised, they certainly possess greater durability than do policy changes within given rules. Again, this is one of our intellectual weaknesses. For example, we all agree on the desirability of replacing discretionary policy with a monetary constitution. However, when it comes to the specific type of monetary constitution, our opinions differ widely. Some favor a fixed monetary rule, others want a gold standard or competing currencies or a variety of different remedies, and the same is true of the fiscal constitution. The wide discrepancy of views in our camp reduces the likelihood of significant success. That's why we have no a priori reason for being complacent, satisfied with the present state of affairs. We are not necessarily winning. I would like to end, however, on a moderately optimistic conclusion. First of all, if it is true that we are not winning in the sense that we don't have generally accepted constitutional solutions for the major problems of our times, it is also true that they are losing. The statist recipes, once so popular, are totally discredited so that our opponents don't know what to say. But there is another reason for being optimistic. Like Churchill at the time of World War II, we can base our confidence in the future on their mistakes. The cumulative effect of decades of socialism has produced a state of near bankruptcy, which makes further expansions of government interference almost impossible. Statism is both intellectually and financially bankrupt. It has a past, albeit an inglorious one, but it has no future. Under these circumstances, it is difficult to imagine any further growth in the size of government. Maybe the change of rhetoric is not to be credited to our intellectual victories, being only a reflection of the simple arithmetic of government bankruptcy. In any case, if present trends continue, instead of capitalism being killed by its success, as Schumpeter maintained, we shall see socialism destroyed by its failures. Definitely, these are glorious days for us reactionaries. Thank you.